Make an Impact podcast presented by the American Association of Suicidology. I'm Chris Cosentino, and today we are joined by Eric Cusin, founder and CEO of Same Here Global Mental Health Movement. Eric, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, man. For everyone who's watching, you should know that Chris has his Rangers gear in the back and I'm wearing my Islander shirt. So we're already starting off on a good note.
So listen, before we jump into Same Here, let's rewind the tape and find out how we got here to this point right now. What was it that really inspired you to make an impact?
Yeah, I mean, obviously this is a much longer story typically, so I'll give the 2-minute cliff notes of it. Professional sports executive for 20 years, didn't think mental health applied to me. End up becoming chief revenue officer of the Florida Panthers. 6 months in, my brain and my body just absolutely give out on me. It's like I'm a dysfunctional mess. And that might sound derogatory towards some people, but there's the only way I could describe the way it was in my head. Couldn't put sentences together, couldn't look at people in the eyes and have conversations, and went the traditional route that most of us go, which is I have a chemical imbalance. I need to find out what that chemical imbalance is by whatever label I have. Go get the medications that I need. I left Florida to come back to New York to get to the, quote, best doctors. And I say, quote, because I think there's different types of best doctors when we look at it that way. There's certainly different opinions in terms of what best is. But I came up here where all the Ivy League doctors were. And for 2.5 years, I laid in a bed, still dysfunctional, being told I had melancholic depression, anhedonic depression, PTSD, OCD, ADHD, tried on 52 different psychotropic drug combinations, TMS therapy, ultimately ECT shock therapy, none of them working for me. And then eventually meeting a woman who practices something called integrative psychology, where I learned through nothing more than her asking me about the story of my life. She wasn't trying to psychoanalyze me. She wasn't asking about the relationship with my mother growing up. Just tell me about your life. And the background there is I have an older brother. And from the time I was 8 years old, this is what came out of me. This wasn't necessarily the focus of my share. He broke his femur bone, was in a body cast for a year and homeschooled. Then a year later, gets diagnosed with ALL, children's form of leukemia. So 5 years of chemo and radiation, late 80s, early 90s, not the best prognosis, but miracle, goes into remission. A month later, he's in a Jeep Wrangler with his friends, open top, no seatbelt, car loses control. He flies out of the back, cracks his head open on the parkway. Heals from that, goes to college, feeling a pain in his knee. Cancer from childhood's returned. Now that it's returned, it gives them the need to give him a stronger dose of the chemo, which does a great job in lowering the cancer cell counts, but it also beats up the healthy cells in his body. He eventually goes into septic shock from the chemo treatments, 105 fever, falls into a coma. He's in a coma for 3 months. We don't know if he's going to wake or have any brain activity. Miracle wakes, full cognitive faculties, but his kidneys fail from the rigor of the septic shock. So he needs to go on dialysis. We all get tested to see who's the closest match. My father is donating a kidney to him. That's all successful. Celebrations. I get my first job at a college at the NBA league office. That year, 3 of my close friends pass away back to back to back of either misdiagnosed or undiagnosed heart conditions. I shared that in the beginning when you asked what my motivation is, because what I learned was from that first session that I had with that woman, I'm at 35 with this crash that happened to me in Florida, yet I'm telling her about my life. I've gone from age 8 to age 23, and she stops me and she asks what else happened to me as a child and a young adult that impacted my mental health. I didn't know that there was a connection there. I thought I had a genetic chemical imbalance. And that's what was happening to me. And for 2.5 years, I'm trying the meds to balance out my imbalance. What I was sitting on was a bedrock of trauma from all that time as a child, not knowing how it was changing the physiology, the biology of my system. And once I learned what stress and trauma were, my mission became, there's not a person on this planet who doesn't deal with divorce of parents, job loss, verbal abuse, sexual abuse, bullying, cyberbullying, sickness of loved ones, loss of loved ones, watching your parents care for their sick parents. Like the amount of stressful and traumatic things, add to it now COVID, add to it now we're in a global war. Like there's not a person that walks around without the buildup of what I just call stuff inside of us. And our entry point into this conversation about either mental health or suicide, unfortunately, oftentimes starts with the label and the diagnosis or an attempt or a loss. And we're talking to the family member. And it doesn't start with, what did you live through? What happened to you? That's the part that's the commonality that brings us all together, hence the name Same Here, hashtag Same Here, so it's searchable. It's an American Sign Language sign. You and I were the same. meaning no matter who I speak to, you're a human being and you've been through challenging life events. That puts us on the same team. It doesn't have to be, Chris, you have depression, I have anxiety, we don't understand each other. It has to be, we've all been through stuff that's led us to a place where we're all impacted.
No, I absolutely love it. And the first time we met in person was at the 2023 World Suicide Prevention Day benefit. And it's funny, the conversations leading up to it, it's like, you know, we just met, but I feel like, you know, we have so much of the same backgrounds and we've gone through so much stuff, you know, and growing up in a sports lifestyle, you know, I played hockey my whole life. I coached, you know, I feel like we grew up in that same era of, you know, all right, just put some dirt on it, you know, toughen up and things like that. And you look back on it now. And as you get older and, you know, I have a daughter and it's, you become more aware of the mental challenges that kids go through, you know, and I think you become a lot more, you know, I guess sensitive to those things.
Once you see health holistically, you can't unsee it, right? I think that's the thing. Like you and I grew up in the era of going to school where the American Heart Association, since you run a charity now, trying to educate people on suicide and the risk signs and the warnings and unfortunately what to do after when we lose someone. The American Heart Association put a tremendous model out there for the rest of us. They taught us that plaque builds in our arteries. They did it through quirky, fun cartoon characters of hearts jumping rope and shooting basketballs. And we helped them raise money by doing it. And it was called Jump Rope for Heart and Hoops for Heart. But we learned that we can't just sit around because this stuff builds up inside of us and eventually can cause damage later on down the road, right? And similar thing right now, unfortunately, with mental health is what's the basis for how it grows inside of us? We certainly get into in this talk. And then where can it lead? Because everyone, when we're talking about suicide, and I think this is where, you know, I started off the conversation with Chris in a joking, fun way about sports between the Islanders and Rangers, because this topic often gets introed in such a heavy way. And I get it. The topic is heavy. And as you hear my story play out more, suicidal ideations are what sent me to the hospital, to the psych ward, a term that's so scary. But if we don't talk about it in everyday conversation like this, the way that we talk about heart attacks and the way that we talk about prevention related to heart attacks, we're going to continue to lose more people. So we need to find this balance between we're talking about it like everyday folks and it's a very serious topic. Where's that sweet spot?
Yeah, same here has such a strong presence on social media where you're really examining and discussing current events and you know, it's sports, it's entertainment. But what I love in your posts and what you do is you really examine the way these stories are being talked about, the way they're being reported. Why is it so important that, you know, when we talk about mental health or we talk about suicide, it is so important that we are reporting about these responsibly. It seems like, you know, the New York Post, right? It'll put these sensationalized headlines up just to get the eyes on and the clicks. But you know, you know, I would love to hear your philosophy on the way mental health and suicide is being reported.
I live in my head probably too much, right? We should live a little bit more in our bodies. And so in living in your head, you examine things closely and you look at words and the way that they're used because the world looks like a puzzle to you and you want to figure out how pieces should fit together better. And so when I got in this space and I started realizing the binary way in which we as a society talk about it, and then the media capitalizes on that. I mean, there's no hiding behind the fact that the media is looking for eyeballs. There's a sensationalism piece to this, which is driving people to look at more of the train wreck. Okay, that goes away. What's the new train wreck? Okay, that goes away. What's new train wreck? Let's use the loss of college athletes as an example. There was a barrage of losses one after another. The only media outlet that I saw cover it in the collective was the Today Show. They had five of the families of the Helinski Hope and Katie Meyer and that whole crew and Sarah Schulz and you know, different athletes from different schools. And that's only one bucket of society, but at least was showing a thread. And the Today Show hasn't had that group back on yet. And when a new suicide happens, they don't tie it back. Here's the one outlet willing to show that there's a thread. And now the conversation doesn't continue through that thread. So what it seems like to society is Well, these are individual stories. They're interesting to read about, but they don't relate to one another. And so the nuance that I try to bring to the conversation on social is this is all being positioned as different things, and it's all being positioned in a sensationalized way, and it's not being normalized that what underlies this all is the stress and trauma underlay that then leads to the overdose, the suicide, the mass shootings, all the things that we as a society put in separate buckets and say, wow, Vincent Jackson died of because he was an alcoholic. He was drinking alone in his hotel room. Well, why was he drinking? What led him there, right? So since you talked about verbiage, I'll just give very specific on the suicide piece. The press spends way too much time. You could say maybe it's because they're uneducated. I'd say it's a balance between they're uneducated and it's a more sensational story, is they always use choice in the headlines. What could have made had them make this decision? Why did they leave people behind? And as someone who's felt the ideations myself, as someone because I felt the ideations and talk openly about it and then have people come and talk to me, I can tell you that in the majority of these cases, and the numbers show how impulsive these actions are, 87% of people who've attempted suicide, unfortunately, who've lived, right? Those are the only people we can ask. It was the thought came into their mind within 24 hours, 25% of them within 5 minutes of their attempt. This is not, I'm sitting there with a pro and con list and making a decision, oh, things are good, things are bad, there's more bad than good, so I don't want to be here anymore. So there's a case in point example. When we're even campaigns like, I'd rather listen to your story than go to your funeral. That stigmatizes it further. And I hate the term stigma, so I don't use it in campaigns. But you're shaming people in that way because you're saying, if only you had the courage to come and talk to me, it'd be better than losing you and the choice that you're making for it to go away. It's not a choice. What we need to be saying to people is, whatever you're feeling, however intense it is, just like when you have the feelings of a heart attack, you can come and talk to me. You come and talk to me at any point. I'm always here. There's never any judgment. That's the way it needs to be. And the thing is, we hold on to each other's isms, and then we just build off of them and we repeat them because there's an alliteration or there's a rhyme. So that's why I focus so much on the verbiage, is because I think the verbiage is wrong, number one. I think number two, we're putting out a message of binaries, who has it and who doesn't. Let's look at the people who has it and examine them. It's a topic for all of us.
We're chatting with Eric Hewson, founder and CEO of Same Here Global Mental Health Movement. And this conversation about reporting and verbiage, it's, you know, and how, you know, when stories are put out there in the media, do you feel there's this more reactive than proactive approach? And how do you think we can kind of fix that?
Well, you know, before you started with AAS, I had a conversation with the folks at AAS. We have to rehash it back. Speaking of the great event that you all had with Kendall Toole from Peloton, and giving her an award, it was. I kind of whispered in your ear over loud music about getting you back involved in something that we do called the Lifesaver campaign. We are proactive with fire safety. Okay, every kid in school learns stop, drop, and roll. It's not very involved or detailed or something that's difficult to remember. It's not anything that's like this, you know, a brain surgeon would need to come up with. It's like, when you catch on fire, you get on the floor and you roll around because that gives you the best chance of survival. Why do we proactively talk about that when only 0.03% of people in our population ever catch on fire? And yet with suicide, we go, wait, we had a loss in the community. Okay, now let's have a suicide. I mean, our buddy Aaron Taylor, now I've introduced you to, and hopefully you'll become good friends with, college football analyst and College Football Hall of Famer and NFL champ. You know, there was a loss in his community. And so he called and asked me if I had resources, and I connected him with you. But why is that happening after the fact? So Lifesaver, L-I-F-E, four different steps that we should be talking about suicide in the first person of what to look out for. Because if enough people have had the ideations, and they have, because 15 million people a year in the U.S. alone have the ideations, why are we not getting it? Look, there's a fine line between a graphical explanation of the ways and means that it's done. I'm not advocating for that. But to teach kids what a self-harm error message on repeat sounds like in your brain, and that when that starts, That's not something to play around with. That's not something to flirt with. That's something to go and ask for help for right away. And here's how you ask for that help. That then normalizes the conversation in a proactive way where I can go, hey, Chris, that guy, Eric, who spoke at school, I'm having those thoughts that he was describing. Can you help me? Right? So we need to divorce ourselves from the isms in this space of, are they giving away possessions? Right? Did they, you know, start to speak about dark things going on in their lives and wanting it to end? Okay, those are things to look out for in other people. It's probably late in the process to get there. Okay. So how do we get in front of it from the standpoint of first person teaching people what the ideation might feel like if they are to come over them? That's number one. Then a whole separate conversation we can have if you want to dive into it of tools related to understanding nervous system states and doing check-ins, because we can actually start to see when disassociation starts to happen because the nervous system becomes overwhelmed, and that's when suicidal ideations start to take place. So if we could teach people what thoughts, feelings, and behaviors we start to have that lead towards an overwhelm of our nervous system, that lead towards the ideations before the ideations ever start, we can get in front of it. And we could get in front of it ourselves. And from a tracking mechanism perspective, we can get in front of it where teachers are checking with students, where coaches are checking with athletes. We're not doing that stuff right now. We're waiting till after the fact and going, oh, is that person looking really sad right now? Well, are they giving away the possessions? Okay, now there's an issue. We should go send them for help.
Yeah, one of the great tools, and I love your site at samehereglobal.org. You have the Same Here scale, right? Where folks can kind of, you know, evaluate how they're feeling, whether they're thriving or sinking. And do you see that as a great tool that, like you said, like, you know, the fire safety, or we should have these things in schools. We should have these resources, because one of the first things I learned since coming over to AAS really has been the conversation about suicide. That there was this misconception that I always thought that once you talk about suicide, it's going to lead to a suicide, but that's not the case at all. And so, the more and more I'm learning and the more people that I'm meeting in this community, it's like, no, we have to talk about these things responsibly and providing tools to get people to be more comfortable with sharing how they're feeling. So, you know, where did that scale come from?
It's interesting that you brought that up, because what I was describing to you when you asked the previous question was essentially the scale without saying the scale. I'm glad your mind went there. So before I learned any of the science of the nervous system, because I ended up becoming a student of it, I just intuitively, what I felt after starting to heal and going on a healing journey, and I'm still on that healing journey. I don't want anyone to think Eric's healed, right? Or Chris is healed. I think we all go through stuff, it impacts us, and then we're learning how to heal throughout the rest of our lives from some of the stuff we went through as a little kid. But I saw kind of three phases I was living in. One was, I'm okay. The other one is, I'm kind of struggling. And the other one is, I'm awful, right? That's not scientific at all. It's just three phases. It's, you're able to balance things pretty well. Things start to become overwhelming because there's a lot going on. And now I can't handle it all. What do I do, right? So I was thinking about mental health across a continuum early on. I had a graphic designer create, it was surviving, struggling, and sinking were the three words. It was only three at the time. And when I started to become more and more familiar with the doctors who are on our alliance, who I had met, integrative mental health professionals from all over the globe, from Hong Kong to Houston, right? Alliteration off the S or off the H. I started asking them more and more about this continuum thing. They're like, Eric, have you ever heard of polyvagal? I'm like, no, but I know about the vagus nerve. Is that what you mean? And they're like, yeah, it actually ties to that. And what I started learning was, okay, with our nervous system, polyvagal tells us there's three states. The three states are called ventral vagal, which is a balance between the sympathetic and the parasympathetic nervous system. So we've got these two responses in our nervous system. Autonomic is the top. It branches off. And you could have parasympathetic, which is in the moment. I think of key as present, being able to pay attention. S as stress response. Okay. Well, in that first phase of ventral vagal, I can go into the stress response when I need to, but my predominant response is parasympathetic, rest and digest in the moment. So I have this balance between the two. Second phase that they call sympathetic, aptly so, is when the sympathetic nervous system goes threat, 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 stress, 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 over and over and over again. There's too many things going on. Then their third phase is what they call dorsal vagal, which is shutdown, which is this, the stress has been going on for too long. There's been too many windows open on our computer. It's time to shut down. I took that concept I got with the doctors because obviously I don't want to create something just as a marketer that speaks to me. I wanted to create something that had a focus group of teachers, of students, of school professionals, of parents, of everyday advocates, and of doctors. And what we did was we said three, and the words that they use are not going to become digestible to people. Most people are not going to become comfortable with ventral vagal, sympathetic, and dorsal vagal. It's just too science focused. So we took those three and we broke them down into six because we think there's actually six places within those three, being a little bit broader. Thriving, gliding, and surviving is where we're at when we're in that first phase. Thriving being in the zone, gliding being kind of like, I'm doing well and well enough that things are going in a good direction. Surviving being, I'm still mostly in my parasympathetic response, but I'm kind of just getting by. So those are the first three phases on the left of the scale. Then fluctuating and struggling are when now you're getting to this place of the oversympathetic response. The stress response is getting overwhelming. So you're kind of one foot in, one foot out. I don't know what's going on. Struggling is, oh my God, wow, the world feels like it's overwhelming and like there's too much on my plate and I can't handle it all. And then the final phase on the scale is sinking, which a lot of people call the freeze mode of the nervous system. It's where I was for that 2.5 years of my life. When the system becomes overwhelmed, shutdown happens. And it's very different than just putting generic emojis up there, because when we see generic emojis across a linear plane, they always go from happiest to saddest. That's not how the nervous system works. I would love to have been sad when I was in my worst place. That would have meant I was feeling a certain type of emotion. The nervous system gets to a place where it shuts down and can't feel anything. That's why that sinking emoji has no affect whatsoever. So yes, we bring the scale into schools, either manually or through the app we have, Same Here Scale, and we allow teachers to do check-ins with students and then graphically look at those check-ins in a non-diagnostic way. That's what's needed. If we don't do that, what ends up happening is we are completely in the dark as to whether or not someone is struggling or not. I don't know if you saw that ad that came out during World Mental Health Day. It was a football team, and I think it was Liverpool or wherever it was. And there's a gentleman sitting down and he's sullen, and all the fans around him and his best friend are cheering, and they're cheering, and there's somber music. And it says, some of us don't notice the signs of, you know, mental health challenges. And eventually, after about 45 seconds of the commercial, that sullen guy comes back and he has to put the scarf on his friend's chair. The one who's cheering the whole time is the one that passed the suicide. So it totally flips the narrative. We're not trained to look out for signs just by looking at someone visually and going, what's wrong with them? That's all the more reason why we need check-in tools with common language. If we don't have common language for folks to be able to open up and share, we lose the ability to get in front of this and be proactive.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I you know, having coached hockey for, you know, a little more than 15 years, and you go through all this safe sport testing, and everything's mandatory. And, you know, and since I came over to AAS, you know, I took a QPR training. And as I'm going through the QPR training, which is to really recognize the signs and direct folks into the right direction, it's for anybody. And I really encourage everyone to take a QPR training. The thing with it, I'm sitting through this training. I'm like, I wish I learned this back when I was coaching for 15 years. QPR training, that type of training should be mandatory for teachers, for everyone who's around children or anyone, colleagues, anybody, to recognize these signs. And that's what I love. You know, one of the main things I really, really love about Same Here, you have so many influencers, celebrities, athletes that use their platforms to talk about what they're going through, their own personal struggles. And I think we need more of that. I think we need more people stepping up and being comfortable to talk about that, because I think it is one of the most brave thing anybody can really do is to share their story in a public forum, because it's what they own that.
Well, I, I'm, I'm excited to talk about that topic because I'm opinionated on it, maybe too much so. I love that athletes are talking. And ironically, right before I got on with you, someone sent me a link of, if you remember the receiver on the Baltimore Ravens, Torrey Smith, right? And so he's talking about his challenges that we go. I'm purposely phrasing this, please. It's about a 2-minute clip. And my friend, you know what happens like when people tag you on social media to a clip that's already on there, meaning they want you to take a look at this. So I watch it, and the first 5 seconds of it are the boilerplate template of how they want athletes to share. And I cringed a little bit at first because my friend wanted me to see it. And I'm like, I don't know if I want to react positively to it, which was, I'm Torrey Smith, and I've struggled with depression and anxiety while I was an NFL player. And I was like, okay, we're back to binaries again, which is the way in which athletes and celebrities are trained to share. What's my name? What's my label? What happened? What did I take to get better? I think, unfortunately, just like the Just Say No to Drugs campaign, when we enter the conversation that way, we enter the conversation and the people who don't either think they have a label or don't think it applies to them goes, that's not me, tune out right away. So while we're motivating the people who've been diagnosed already to go, Torrey Smith has it too. You're not alone. It's a great message for them. We don't think about, because there's not a dislike button on social media, how many people does it turn off? Where I was pleasantly surprised is he continues to talk, and he talks about the help that he was getting when he was playing for the Ravens. And he goes, you know, it wasn't until I went into the office and we started talking about my childhood, and the doctor starts talking to me about the difficult neighborhood that I grew up in. And I start opening up and sharing some of the images that I saw as I was a kid and some of the struggles that I was going through that were, and he says the magic words, were building up inside of me all that time up until the point I became an NFL player. Then I was like, I can get behind this message. Because what we do in this space way too often, because it's a space outside of what hopefully AAS and Same Here is doing, where we try to educate. There's a lot of folks and a lot of organizations in the space that try to sell. They sell their solutions. So what's the quickest way to sell the solution? ABC celebrity, I struggle with XYZ disorder, use 123 solution. That's not a model that normalizes. That's a model that continues to make the topic binary. So I'm with you that it's amazing when athletes or entertainers open up, but only when it's from the angle of what have they been through that normalizes we all go through challenges more so than what their label is.
Do you think now, going back to when you first got into professional sports, has there been a shift? Do you think has there been improvements in the focus in providing athletes with mental health support? You know, where do you stand with that?
I think that I go team to, I was with the Ravens, ironically, not unrelated to the Torrey Smith thing. I was with the Ravens with their business staff last week. And what's interesting was, and I'm not airing any dirty laundry, they would have no problem with me sharing this. They feel like their football side, their players are in a better place than their business staff is right now because they have an in-house clinician who she didn't position herself as the person who sits behind the door and waits for you to come in. She proactively started getting on the field, meeting with the players, getting them to know that she was a human being. And that started conversations, which led to, hey, going to Dr. Trish is not a scary thing. It's going to help me in my performance. So I would say the answer is complicated. It's case by case right now because more and more organizations have people internally who are addressing it, but the way the it is being addressed is different from organization to organization. I have a baseball team that I work with in the MLB where the way I was introduced was the practitioner said, I sit in my office and no one comes in. I'm a figurehead to check the box. And we had to work on how do you actually get into the fold with the players, start to get yourself being known not as the doctor, as the human being. So the answer is complicated in that there's more resources being provided, but more resources being provided doesn't necessarily mean the conversation is happening at an easier, more human to human level. And that's the next step where we need to take this.
That's great. We're once again joined by Eric Hewson, founder and CEO of Same Here Global Mental Health Movement. Eric, I, you listen, I, like I said, we kind of grew up in the same era of that old school quote unquote mentality, and I've always been a strong believer. And listen, I think if you want to grow, you're going to have to, you know, overcome adversity. You're going to have to go through some failures and not be afraid of failures. And that's part of your process. Do you feel society as a whole might be protecting people too much from that and not letting folks, you know, go through the tough times? And, you know, one of the best things, you know, throughout my coaching career, I was able to build a great relationship with John Tortorella, now the head coach of the Philadelphia Flyers. And one of the things he had taught me was, you know, as a coach, you really need to invest time into getting to know each player individually. Sometimes a player might need to have their hand held and you walk them through it. Sometimes they do need a little kick in the tail, you know, and other times you just got to let them, leave them alone and let them figure out on their own. And sometimes you're going to make some mistakes along the way, but really investing that time into each individual. And, you know, you always hear, you don't treat everybody the same. You don't treat everybody the same because everybody's different. Everybody has different buttons. Everybody's going through something different. What's your take on the way society is encouraging, you know, growth from that point of view?
Yeah. There were probably about 10 years ago was when social media was becoming popular. What it became popular to then rip on in the sports community was, we're creating a society of soft people. Everyone gets a participation trophy, right? So I'm not advocating for that way of going about it. I don't think everyone should get a participation trophy. I think some of the greatest lessons I learned playing sports was how to lose graciously and then how to come back better. You know, being a hockey fan, you'll appreciate how Tampa Bay lost in the first round to Columbus after they were President's Trophy, right? And then the discomfort and angst and anger that they had, that they came back the next year and then they become a dynasty, right? Because they went through the trials and tribulations. So I think that there is something that we learn through sports, and I don't think you can shield kids from the loss, because I think that they learn things in the loss that's so part of then how they become better and are able to overcome challenges later on. You also need to find a balance as a coach. You can't be the coach who does the old school way anymore, that goes suck it up and play on when someone is crying about something. You got to find out why the person's crying, because now we're in a phase where we realize that can be a life or death situation. I won't out the coach, but there's an NHL coach who was known for going up and down in the locker room if someone was on their phone and was tearing up, which is a natural human emotion. If you're breaking up with your girlfriend or you're a fight with your wife or whatever it is, and he would say, that shit goes outside, doesn't happen in the locker room. You can't say that. You cannot. So there's a balance between, let's not protect people from adversity, but when people are going through adversity, let's allow people go through adversity. But when they go through adversity, let's coach them along the way and show them the lessons. I'm here for you to go through that. And what do we take away from this? So it's a balance, right? But I think taking away adversity completely, giving participation trophies and telling everyone that everyone wins, that doesn't prepare us for life either.
Yeah, no, I agree with you there. It's so same here. What do you have going on right now? I mean, you just had an event. What's going on?
So I'm flying today to Miami. We're doing the third annual. I don't love the name of the event. Again, I'm very transparent, but I was asked to help be a part of it in year one. So I stayed with them as it's grown. It's called Recovery Day. So I'll give you a peek behind the curtain. Why is it called Recovery Day? Because in sports teams, sales are very important. Ticket sales. The Dolphins 3 years ago were not selling a lot of tickets because the team wasn't great. How are they going to get groups to come out? They targeted the recovery community. And so they created Miami Dolphins Recovery Day. And we had the Same Here logo on the front of the shirt, and it was in Dolphins colors. And to see the Same Here logo next to a Dolphins logo is really rewarding and exciting. As 1,000 people, we come pregame and, you know, we do an address to that group prior to the game. Awesome. Amazing experience. But the name to me doesn't speak to me. And there were a couple speakers, and I'm the last speaker, and I have to kind of round it up and bring it up together. And other people got up there when they talked, and they were like, I'm Chris and I'm an alcoholic. Hey, Chris, right? I got up there and I go, I'm Eric and I'm a holic. And people are like, what the hell is this guy talking about? And I wanted to shake them a little bit first. And I said, there's 1,000 of us here, but there's 66,000 other in that building when we go in there that are all going through something also, that are all recovering from something. You brought it up with sports earlier. I brought it up with working. We go through emotional pain and then we dive into something that we love doing. That's an addiction in and of itself because it takes us away from that emotional pain. So whether you deal with coping through food, through burning, through cutting, through shopping, through work, the group that just happened to be there at that time was brought together because recovery in their mind was recovery from alcohol and drugs, which is a big part of the recovery community. I get that. But when we talk about it just through the narrow focus lens of recovery in the traditional sense, it's those 1,000 people who are there. There's camaraderie amongst them. But then, okay, everyone else, 66,000 in the stadium who are in there, doesn't apply to them. And so it's encouraging that we've been able to do it for 3 years because it's a lot of the same people coming back, that the message is getting seeded to them. It's not you here alone. It's you here as a representative of them. Have the conversations when you're going into the stadium, when they see the shirt. Why are they wearing what they're wearing? You're wearing it because you want to open up conversation that everyone else is going through things too, and you can come to this event next year, right? So it's those types of things where there's a documentary we're working on, which I can fill you more in on, which is using the power of celebrity storytelling along with everyday people storytelling to show we're all going through challenging life events. And it's really, as folks hopefully will hear this and the popularity of the Chris podcast becomes that much more, out there and he gets hundreds of thousands of listeners. On our end, I would say a big push is getting the scale into as many places as we possibly can because we need a common language in mental health. And depressed or not, anxious or not, is not a language. That's a binary. When you have a continuum of explaining to people how you feel, that's common language where I can check in with my friend. He can let me know where he is and we can dive deeper on the why. So a lot of initiatives that we could speak about, but hopefully those are some of the main ones that are helpful to hear.
I appreciate that. And I guess my last question is, what would be that one first piece of advice that you give someone who might be going down that same road that you've been on? What would be that, if you had that roadmap in your hand, say, okay, this is your first stop. Where would you point them?
Yeah, it what saved my life, I think, when I went to that woman and then her integrative psychiatrist who she was connected with. So I'm using the term integrative, right? Holistic, many different ways in which to look at mental health. That doctor's name is Dr. Richard Brown, and I don't out him so that people in flood his box because the guy, his friggin' voicemail says, I can't take on new patients because and it kills me that unfortunately that's the situation that he's in. I should say it hurts me in fairness to the language. It hurts me because the best doctors, they're inundated, they're overwhelmed. But the end of the first appointment I had with him, he said, Eric, here's 15 things we may be able to do to help. And after this 15, there's 15 more. And after those 15, there's 15 more. That was a completely different conversation than I had with every other mental health professional that I went to, which was, here are the meds you can try. And we're going to do talk therapy along the same way. We've been told for way too long, med management and talk therapy, med management and talk therapy. What that does to us as patients is it makes us believe that we're this thing called treatment resistant when we don't get better from the two things they tell us are the gold standards. There are thousands of things that are out there, Havening, tapping, EMDR, brain spotting. We call them STAR exercises, stress and trauma, active release and rewiring. So if I could tell anyone anything is that there's always hope because what you feel like when you start to get to that place of homicidal ideation, suicidal ideation from the disassociation you're feeling, you feels like you're in this narrow tunnel where there is no light. You have to believe that people on the outside can see the light for you and that light does exist. In your mind, I know for anyone who's hearing this, I know it feels like in your head, there is no hope. No one's denying that that's what it feels like, but your brain is also lying to you because of the situation it's in. When you're in that sinking shutdown mode, the brain is telling you there's nothing we can do now. There are all these things we can do and hold on with us. Let us be your partner, hold you through it. We're going to get through it. Kendall O'Toole, when she came to your event, said the same thing. There is always hope. There's always a way to get through this. And I truly believe that.
Eric Hewson, founder and CEO of Same Here Global Mental Health Movement. You can find Eric on social media. You can also visit the website at sameheareglobal.org. Eric, I really appreciate it, bud. Let's do this again sometime.
Good for AAS for launching a podcast. Good for you for taking the initiative on it. For everyone who wants to know about the AAS organization, Chris is bringing new energy to it. And that's not a knock on the existing. It's just nice to always have different angles that come in. And when you can approach a heavy topic through a creative lens in a way that's engaging, it's huge. And so please continue to listen to his podcast, because they're going to save many lives by doing it this way. I think this is a great step you all are taking.
Appreciate you, buddy. We'll talk soon, okay?
Thanks, Chris.